a.k.a. Mr. WGXC, and you are listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM and WGXC.org. Listen in, y'all.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. David Lombardo reports in the Albany Times-Union that Democrat Antonio Delgado raised far more money for his campaign in the past 3 months than his Republican opponent, incumbent John Faso. Delgado from Rhinebeck raised $3.35 million in contributions, while Faso from Kinderhook brought in $977,617. According to federal election filings, Delgado has $1.75 million to spend before Election Day, and Faso has $1.4 million. Chris Martin, the regional press secretary for the National Republican Campaign Committee, admitted that Democrats, and I quote, are energized, end quote, but said, and I quote, at the end of the day, these are Republican districts, end quote. But a Democratic strategist disagreed. Evan Stavinsky said, and I quote, a lot of people talk about a blue wave, but there has also been a green wave. It's been absolutely a story of the election. For Faso, 66.7% of his donations came from individuals rather than political action committees. Delgado raised 94.2% from individuals. Read the full story in the Albany Times-Union. Richard Moody reports from Columbia Green Media that Ginsburg's Foods is one of the first local businesses to sign up for a new program with the Columbia County Probation Department to assist people on probation in getting jobs. Columbia County Probation Department Director Vincent Dotto said, and I quote, this is something we just started this year. We had our first session in September, end quote. The Ready, Set, Work program under the State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision teaches job-seeking skills for those on probation. The first session of the program had two participants, and one was hired by Ginsburg's Foods on the night warehouse team. Dotto said, and I quote, Ginsburg said they like the work he's doing for them. It's important to have partners in the community like Ginsburg's to help with this. We have been lucky in Columbia County that there are a lot of employment opportunities in the area, and we have a high percentage of people on probation who get jobs, end quote. Ginsburg's Foods CEO Suzanne Rancic praised the program. She said, and I quote, when we were presented with the opportunity to be the launch partner in the Columbia County Probation Department's new Ready, Set, Work program, we jumped at it. Ginsburg's Foods is committed to our community, committed to our people, and always looking for opportunities to develop relationships with forward-thinking organizations, end quote. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Amanda Purcell reports for Columbia Green Media that after years of asking, dog owners in Hudson might finally get a park to walk their pets. A dog park was a campaign promise of Hudson Mayor Rick Rector, and he held an information session about the idea October 15th at the Hudson Library. Rector says three locations might be suitable for dogs. Charles Williams Park at 238 Mill Street, a bit of land on North 2nd Street, south of the former dump, and the former Foster's Refrigerators site on North 2nd Street. Last December, the Common Council voted against putting a dog park in the Charles Williams Park. According to the resolution the council passed, and I quote, the council believes that issues surrounding safety to the public, cleanliness, and the general prudence of constructing a dog park at Clarence Williams Park weigh against such a park being constructed and operated at this location, end quote. The second site got most of the attention at the meeting this week. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Kenneth Lovett reports in the Daily News that Mark Molinaro on October 16th stopped blasting radical leftists for a Manhattan fight and vandalization last weekend and started blaming his own party for the brawl. A Manhattan Republican club invited the head of an ultranational right-wing group, the Proud Boys, to speak over the weekend. Gavin McInnes is known for spewing hate, but Molinaro said he was not aware of his background when he first commented on the issue. Molinaro said, and I quote, "It was suggested to me that I am at the top of the ticket. I don't know if I appreciated that and the immediacy of what occurred at the Metropolitan Republican Club," end quote. A fight broke out, and opponents of the hate group vandalized the Republican space where he spoke. Molinaro, currently the Dutchess County executive running for governor, said he is, and I quote, "a bit ashamed," end quote, that the club invited the racists to speak over the weekend. Molinaro told the Daily News editorial board, and I quote, "I'm embarrassed these individuals were invited to speak. McInnes's language and behavior, though some seem to describe it as a form of comedy, I find it to be highly intolerant language which incites violence," end quote. That puts him at odds with New York GOP Chairman Ed Cox, who said McInnes was invited because of an assuming skit he had performed previously that reenacted some Japanese history. Read the full story in the Daily News. And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
During the pullover pledge drive are Max Hamill, who is the host of Instrumentality. He's going to talk more about that when he comes in. And Bobby Previtt. Don't know who Bobby Previtt is. What do you mean, Bobby Previtt? Bobby Previtt's been a guest on my show a number of times, and I'm glad to have him back. Bobby has a very special performance tomorrow evening at Hudson Hall with his Rhapsody Band. And again, I will let him speak about that right now. WGXC.org/donate. This is the time to contribute to community radio, as I said, for Greene and Columbia County. But we're all over the world. WGXC.org. You can listen to us there or on the TuneIn app on your smartphone. I'm Cheryl Kay, and I've been holding down the fort here on Thursday evenings from 7 to 9:30 for over 7 years. Started here in 2011, and I don't think there's any sign of me stopping. 518-697-7400. You can call and pledge your support there, or even easier, WGXC.org/donate. We know there are those of you out there who like to mail in your cash. WGXC, care of Wave Farm, 5662 Route 23 in Acre, New York, 12405. We can use you. You have a lot of choices out there for your local, for your news and weather and sports and all that stuff. But the word here is local. We are right here in Hudson, in Catskill, and in Acre, New York. We see you, we hear you, and we speak to you, whether it's during our public affairs programs or doing our music programs or during our Sunday morning lineup. We have you into the studios telling your story as we tell ours, either through music or through weather reports or through politics. 518-697-7400 or online at WGXC.org/donate. Have you gotten involved with our station? WGXC is always looking for volunteers. I'm going to tell you more about that, but you can go to our webpage right now, WGXC.org. If this is the first time you're listening to us, welcome, 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 as John Oliver would say, and become a part of this media project. We're not just a radio station, we're a media project. WGXC.org/donate. 518-697-7400. Believe me, I will be saying it over and over and over again. You will not miss the information to pledge your support here. Contribute. Keep me on the air. Keep people like Tom DiPietro and Ellen, who followed me or who were before me and do the afternoon show on Thursdays. Don't forget the gentlemen on Wednesday who do the afternoon show. We have a wonderful afternoon block full of all kinds of guests talking about arts and culture and all kinds of stuff.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to At Issue. This is John Kane. Marquita Reese is unfortunately unable to join us today as she's off making money somewhere. We hope to have her back on the program soon. Just so you guys know, I don't know if you've been listening, but this is our pullover pledge drive. We do these a couple times a year to raise money for WGXC. Our goal is 250 new sustaining monthly supporters. And that helps WGXC provide some of the programming that we do to the community. You know, having lived in Hudson for a few years, I think that WGXC is a wonderful jewel in the crown that we get to have. If you look at national politics, if you look at state politics, there seems to be a lot of intractability on both sides in terms of positions. At the local level, conversations seem to be having going on across the aisle to get things done. If you want to change the world that you see, you start with the place that you live. And WGXC is very proud to facilitate those conversations. It can't do that without your support. So please do, if you have not already, pledge a little bit of money to help support WGXC's varied and wonderful programming. You can do that by phone at 518-697-7400, or you can go online to wgxc.org/donate. That is wgxc.org/donate. Or if you like, you can just contribute in person. Stop by our studio here on 4th and Columbia or any of our other studios to make your tax-deductible pledge on contribution in person. And you can have a look around if you'd like to bring cash. I'm sure that we can take that. But let's get started. We are going to be joined a little bit later in the hour by State Senate candidate Pat Strong. She's a Kingston businesswoman who's taking on George Amador for his seat in New York State Senate in the 46th, covering Green, Albany, and parts of Ulster and, I believe, Rensselaer counties. But right now, let's start with an interview I did earlier today with Jonathan Lerner, who's head of Hudson's Conservation Advisory Council. Jonathan, along with our planning board head, Walter Chatham, penned an editorial in the Register Star in September of this year as proponents of Smart Code, which is an overlay system for planning and zoning for municipalities to bring planning and zoning more in line with 21st century city planning needs. City planning, for I think most of us, is a very fascinating thing that we are very interested in. Zoning law is a very Byzantine thing that makes a very fascinating subject very dull and confusing. So listen to this interview by Jonathan Lerner about some of the possible benefits of a smart code system. And later in the hour, we will be joined again by State Senate candidate Pat Strong. So we are here with Jonathan Lerner from the Hudson Conservation Advisory Council. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hi, thank you.
And we are here to talk about zoning and overlays to zoning code, which I'm sure is exciting to many of our listeners.
Well, it's a boring...
Or should be. It should be.
Let me try and make it exciting.
Yes.
Hudson has a kind of zoning that many places in this country have that was generally adopted in the middle of the 20th century, when cars were taking over the world and people were abandoning cities, people who could afford to, and moving to suburbs. And so it is a kind of zoning that mandates large lots, large setbacks, a lot of space around things, and a kind of built form that doesn't mirror what we actually have in most of Hudson, which is a historic grid urban form.
Right, which it reflects an ideology that land is sort of cheap and plentiful and will always be that way.
And that cities are evil and decaying and we want to get away from them.
Right.
But we live in a city that's actually on the way back from decaying. And if you think about what people love about Hudson, the people who visit here, the people who've moved here, and people who've lived here all their lives, a lot of people think it's the beautiful historic architecture, and that's a big piece of it, but it's also the physical form of the city. If you think about other villages and towns in Columbia County or around surrounding counties, almost all of them grew up as crossroads settlements. So they have a kind of amorphous, amoebic form, and they may have equally beautiful historic buildings that we have here, very similar buildings. But there's no other place in Columbia County that has a street grid like ours,
right,
with sidewalks and alleys, narrow lots, houses close together.
Troy is the only municipality I can think of that's nearby that's probably
And Albany is an urban form.
Well,
that
was planned. Yep.
But nowhere in Columbia County, even the beautiful towns like Chatham and Kinderhook don't have an urban form like ours.
No. They may have a block or two of somewhat dense commercial.
Yeah, a block or two of streets along what had been a county road or what is a county road. Right.
But they all have those big setbacks. It's not like buildings are very accessible from the sidewalk.
And so in the end, they're not very walkable.
Right.
And we have the advantage of this kind of built-in walkability. But the zoning we have now, because it was adopted with a different agenda, actually would make it impossible to rebuild Hudson the way Hudson is now, because it has required setbacks. I'm not expert in this, so I don't remember exactly what the dimensions are. I think you have to leave 10 feet on each side of a building unbuilt in your lot. So if your lot is a typical 20 or 25 foot wide Hudson lot, your house is either 5 feet wide or 0 feet wide.
Right.
Impossible. It has required a built area to lot size ratios. It has required minimum housing unit sizes. It requires certain dedicated space for parking.
And this is why when you walk down something like State Street, you might see a lot of houses are up against the sidewalk when they are older buildings. And then sometimes you'll have just a weird house with a setback that has sort of a tiny little front yard. It's a little disjointing, but it probably reflects the time that that lot was built on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, everyone is concerned here about growth and the problems of growth and where, you know, more people want to move here. There isn't really enough housing. There's not enough supply of affordable housing. Where can we expand? How can we expand? one place we could expand is around the sort of former industrial margins of the city, which are basically down close to the river, which unfortunately is a floodplain.
Right, the CAS site.
The CAS site.
The garage door factory, I think, is the other spot.
That's another one, which is not in a floodplain because it's up fairly high. But so there are some
places. It's a brown site.
It's a brownfield, yeah. But it could be remediated, and actually that would be a good place. But actually, that's a great example, because if the garage door site, if people don't have it in their minds, is there's a little street called Hudson Avenue that leads down to the Little League field. It's just off Union Street. And at the end of it, there's quite a large former industrial property where they built garage doors, and it's been sort of moribund for years. And it would be a place where you could put a lot of housing, or even housing and shops if you wanted. The question is, how are you going to do it? If you did it by our current zoning, you'd have to carve out lots that are large enough to accommodate these setbacks and required parking. And you might get, I'm just guessing here, 20 housing lots out of it. So you could build 20 single houses. Or if you extended the Hudson City grid in the same dimensions that it exists up in the main part of Hudson, where you would put in streets and sidewalks and alleys and narrow lots, and build in the same way in Hudson, two or three stories high, you might get 100 housing units, not 15 or 20.
That is significant.
That's really significant.
In our area.
And the other place that we have to expand are empty lots within the city of Hudson. There's quite a few, actually, individual housing lots, these narrow lots that could accommodate a house and a carriage house, or a three-story building with a shop on the ground floor and two apartments above, as we have in other parts of the city. There are also a few larger places, like, let's say, the corner of 4th and State and 4th and Columbia, where there's some kind of large, mostly used for parking now. Those properties could also be developed in the same urban form, or in a urban form that replicates what we already have. So they would, again, be two or three stories high, row houses. I'm just guessing on 4th Street and State and Columbia, those the three big sort of empty lots there.
Right, and for those who need reference, that's the area between Club Helsinki and the Almshouse
The former library.
Former library.
So, you know, there's a county office building and a former store on one corner of there, and then there are these three big corner properties that are, two of them are parking lots, not even paved. One of them, I think, is just a field. If you imagine building, either dividing that into individual lots and building two or three story houses, or treating them as the whole properties they are, but building again in that the same form that replicates what we already have, so that it continues the existing streetscape, it continues the sense of enclosure and intimacy that you have on Hudson Streets, and you get a lot of housing units out of it.
Now, when you say replicating the form, replicating what we already have, you're not talking necessarily about architectural styles.
This
is not like a historic preservation issue or reflecting the historic architectural styles. You could have a totally different architectural style. You're just talking about, and I think it was very interesting because there were some... there were some links that I was reading off of your editorial in the Register Star in September that talked about how function should follow form.
Right.
Right. As part of smart code. It's not talking about architectural style. It's just saying, you know, we want the buildings. I'm going to let
it's about the shape, the mass, the setbacks, how the buildings relate to each other, how they relate to the street. It's not about architectural style. On the other hand.
And it's not about what they do.
No, it could be this, that you could build a building. Let's say you have a lot, wherever it is, you could build a building that had, it was one three-story house. It could be three one-story apartments. It could be a shop or a laundromat or an art studio or a social service agency on the ground floor and two apartments above. It could be sort of any combination of uses. It could be a doctor's office. It could be a corner store. It could be, you know, a tailor shop, whatever use wanted to go in there. We're not talking about separating the uses. We're talking about building, enhancing the existing shape and form of the town. So it's not about style. On the other hand, we have historic districts here that cover parts of the city, not the whole city. So that if we adopted smart code, which is kind of the shorthand for what we're talking about, it doesn't undo the existing historic district requirements. So if you were building within a historic district, you would still have to get approval for your facade from Historic Preservation Commission. and that's okay. But, you know, it doesn't mean you want to build fake historic buildings, but you want to. They would judge a new proposal in terms of its consistency in the same way that smart code does. Is it the same basic scale? Is it the same basic size? Is it going to dwarf the buildings next to it, or is it going to fit in harmoniously?
So two questions that I suppose are related. One is, why do we not just update our existing smart code? And you touched on this a little bit in your editorial, but if you can expand on that.
You mean our existing zoning code,
yes.
Well, if we did a thorough rewrite of our zoning code.
Which is what I think we all agree needs to be done. If you're going to update it, we can't just do this piecemeal.
Well, we can't just make decisions piecemeal the way we're doing it now, giving a variance to every proposal.
It just becomes more and more Byzantine.
And it's not fair, actually, because unless you have the energy and the lawyer to like argue for your variance, you're just not going to go for one because it's too intimidating.
Yeah, we're going to make code enforcement's brain explode.
With that too.
it gets very complicated. But
so
yes.
So there are basically two options. We could completely rewrite the existing code. Mm-hmm. Which would require legal and planning consultants, and probably take a year or two, and we'd have to have money to pay them, and it's a big involved thing. Or we can adopt what's called smart code, which is basically an off-the-shelf overlay. It's a template. It basically allows us, without changing our existing code, it allows us to define different sections of the city, and identify what are the physical characteristics of those sections. For example, the area that's kind of newer than the historic part of Hudson, out towards the hospital and 8th Avenue, the area sort of along Green Street and Fairview, where there's a lot of two-family houses that was built probably around the early 20th century, not in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. That's the characteristic of that area. It's mainly two and three family houses on fairly large lots by Hudson standards. So that's the characteristic of that area. And you might, if you wanted to figure out how to increase density there, you might make sure in your smart code overlay for that part of the city that it's easy, and with there's no restrictions on building, let's say, a garage apartment, or there's no restrictions if you have an empty lot in building another two or three family house that's sort of the same scale.
And one of the restrictions right now is parking, right?
Yes, minimum parking requirements, which...
And let's put a pin in that, because I do want to get back to that. That is an important topic I think we should discuss, but please continue.
So that neighborhood, which already has a certain kind of characteristic form, you would define that. And so any new construction, any new projects would need to meet the general characteristics of that form. In the older, more historic, denser part of Hudson, Allen Street, State Street, Union Street, we have a different form. We have very narrow lots. We have houses with either no setback from the sidewalk or maybe 8 or 10 feet. We have alleys. We have on the alleys many auxiliary buildings, garages, stables, studios, houses. Those would become the sort of characteristics of the form for that of the smart code overlay for the historic part of town, so that in a, if you have to build to or design to, doesn't say that you have to have height restrictions. You could build a very modern building, unless you happen to be in a historic district and your modern building proposal doesn't meet with historic district approval, which is sort of it's a different thing. But
that can work in tandem with historic preservation. Yeah. It can work in the absence of historic preservation.
It's not in any way a conflict with historic preservation.
Right, right.
In fact, it resolves a lot of the potential problems in historic districts, because it already specifies physical form of buildings that is consistent with the existing historic urban fabric.
Now, I know that smart code has had some success in other areas, notably in Miami, which was historically a very
suburban place.
That's it's right. A very suburban. I grew up in the South along the same area. They were all built up in the mid-century. Everything was
sprawl.
So Miami kind of said, okay, we want to do some infill back where we are, and they adopted smart code to some success.
That's right. Also, right down the river, Newburgh has adopted smart code. And interestingly, the historic eastern part of Newburgh adopted it, and the more suburban western part chose not to. Fine. It's not a coercive thing. If we were to adopt it in Hudson, we would take this template. We would have to have a series of public conversations about how we define the different neighborhoods, what are the important descriptive elements of the different neighborhoods, and let's say the people in our little suburb that's kind of out between the middle school and the high school, or rather the intermediate school and the high school, off Harry Howard Avenue, which is a kind of a classic mid-century suburban large lot suburb, as small as it is.
Right.
People there may just want to keep that form. It's an existing form. There's not much empty property there to build on anyway. Maybe smart code wouldn't even be adapted for that neighborhood. So in other words, it's a template you take, and a community then adapts it to protect and enhance the existing form in the areas that choose to do it.
Right. I mean, it would be a little jarring to find brownstones out by the middle school in between all the ranch homes that are already there. Right. So
it is what it is.
Right. And it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Like,
we have to customize it, exactly.
Not just for the city. It can be customized for the neighborhood.
Exactly.
As well. And so I'm reading about the Suburban Retrofit Toolkit. One of the benefits that they talk about for all of these toolkits is that it makes planning more accessible to the layman. I have sat through planning board meetings. I do not consider myself a genius, nor do I consider myself an idiot. It's amazing how lost you can get sometimes in planning board. It's bewildering. And sometimes I notice that it's also bewildering to people who sit on the planning board.
Of course.
And, you know, it's like people are just kind of trying to scratch their heads and make heads and tails.
Well, here's another fact. We live in a precious little city that's chronically short of money, and one of the results of that is we have no official planning capacity here. We have a planning board that reacts to proposals that is comprised of dedicated volunteers, most of whom have no actual training in planning.
Right.
They just appreciate Hudson and they want to do the best thing they can without knowing the ropes of how to do it. So,
and there's a steep learning curve here. Every project is going to be there for 100 years. So if it takes you 10 projects
to get it right.
If it takes you 10 projects to get it right, that's a lot of learning curve.
So if we would adopt smart code, the questions are, I mean, most of the questions just don't even have to get asked. I mean, it's like we're not worried about what the use, which is a lot of what comes up to the planning board now. Well, this is, you want to open a restaurant in what's considered a residential neighborhood. You need a variance for that. Well, we don't care whether it's a restaurant or an office or a house, as long as it's the right height and the right setback and rebuild of the right kind of material so that it fits in on the street.
Kind of sounds like it's turning us into Houston, Texas, which has its charms sometimes.
It has its charms.
It certainly does. So, you know, the planning board, obviously, this does make their job a little bit easier, and it does make planning a little bit more accessible to the layman. Do we worry about losing that sense of expertise? I mean, the more community input that you get, right, the more people who don't have expertise in a certain area are coming in wanting to be heard.
Well, let's say the city decided to adopt the smart code. I think we still will need to get a planning consultant to help lead us through the process I was describing where the different neighborhoods would be defined.
Right.
Once that's defined, then there's sort of no mystery left and there's no kind of Byzantine, bewildering what other adjectives starting with a B can I think of?
Bureaucratic, I like that. Yeah, I know those. Babylonian.
Yeah, because you don't need to go for a use variance. You don't need to discuss the use. All you need to do is make sure that if what's prescribed is buildings no higher than 3 stories, with no greater setback than 12 feet, whatever the specifics are, as long as you meet those general descriptive guidelines, you can go ahead and build.
Now, as we're trying to set the rules of engagement for these smart codes, do we have the information that we need to say we want this to be 3-story? I mean, do we have all that information? I know that we just had a strategic housing action plan come out from the housing task force.
Right.
You know, housing is obviously one of the really big deals in Hudson, and it is one of the issues that is going to vex us for years to come if we don't get a handle on this. Do we have the information that we need to say that things should be no more than 3 stories high or 4 stories high?
I think we have it. A lot of us have it intuitively just because we're here and we look around and we see what's around us. I mean, it would take somebody, like, we would need a planning consultant or a volunteer, a planning task force, which I think is being formed, actually, to sit down and figure out, these would be the boundaries of this neighborhood area. These are the general, it would take a little bit of work. It's not like it's just plug and play. It's not like downloading an app for your phone. It does take some work to adapt it. But, I can sit here right now and tell you that in general, the height of buildings in the central historic part of Hudson is no higher than 3 stories. Is there any 4-story building? There might be 1 or 2 4-story
probably
buildings.
Down towards the water, I think.
Yeah,
that's
fine. There can be like a few exceptions too, so that's a general thing. And the setbacks, and you can say generally, I mean, of course you'd go and measure this before you like set it into the code, but I can tell you just anecdotally, and anybody who's walked around can tell you that setbacks either are 0 line at the sidewalk line or maybe as much as 8 or 10 feet. And maybe like on a street like Union Street, where that kind of varying street front exists, maybe that's what you would want to define to continue so that it wouldn't be a completely uniform street wall. It would be the same kind of random rhythm that we have now if you walk up and down Union Street.
Right.
We can say that the currently buildings are either built of brick or timber. Maybe we would want to say that, prescribe the materials that you have to still build in brick or timber. Like maybe we don't want glass and steel buildings there. Or maybe we don't care about that. I mean, the smart code would define these issues of mass and scale and certain parameters for what the facade of the buildings should be like.
Right.
Without like saying it has to be in the Italianate style of 1856.
I think there's probably a good fight to be had ahead of us there. I certainly don't mind the juxtaposition of really modern building materials and styles next to really old historical stuff. But there are a lot of people in town with some good reason who want to see a more consistent style throughout a neighborhood.
Yeah. Although, you know, I'll tell you, anybody who's been lucky enough to spend any time in Europe visiting small towns in Europe, and these are towns that, you know, typically are like 500 or 800 years old, these like ancient, beautiful villages. In places like Spain and France and England and Italy, you can be walking down one of these, streets from the Renaissance of beautiful, ornate old historic buildings. And right in the middle of them, at exactly the same scale, fit in perfectly, there's like the most stunning modern, you know, minimalist glass building. And it fits perfectly because it's in scale. It has the right setback. It respects the existing urban fabric.
Right. Although I have to say that, you know, I grew up, you know, where I grew up, there was a lot of mid-century architecture, very modernist stuff. A lot of Van der Rohe was kind of prevalent in the neighborhood where my high school was. And when I was growing up, it was very out of vogue. It was considered extremely ugly, right? And I think all architecture goes through this. People have written about this before. Like, it's very hot, and then it trends way down, and then as it becomes more rare because a bunch of the buildings are demolished, the pieces that are left sort of, worm their way into our hearts, and now we never want them to go anywhere, and they're beautiful and stunning. And great example.
Well, this is an issue more of the evolution of taste.
It's true, but that taste does make a difference when you're trying to plan a neighborhood, you will still have a taste in your mouth from older styles. Turning our attention just a little bit away from styles, the other thing that I wanted to ask about, you know, obviously there is an issue in terms of density of housing. Mm-hmm. You know, I was at a meeting the mayor was giving on dog parks recently, but he was talking about development a little bit, and he mentioned, you know, there's only a couple of spaces left, the Kaz warehouse, the garage door factory. You know, there's not many places for Hudson left to expand or build up, and I personally disagree with that. I think that we could build a lot of accessory dwelling units in the alleyways along Hudson.
Absolutely. Huge resource.
Right. And one of the big blocks that we have to this is the parking requirements.
Well, the smart code would completely obviate parking requirements.
Okay.
You can build, if you want to build parking spaces on your property, fine. You know, if you have an alley or whatever, or not. But the problem with the parking requirements is that they prevent the density that we need. And the fact is, I mean, it's a kind of circular thing. People say, well, everybody has to have a car because there's no decent public transportation. There's no decent public transportation because we don't have enough density to support the public transportation.
Right.
If everybody has to have, every housing unit has to be allotted one or two parking places, we could never achieve the density.
So if I'm peering into the future right now, I'm seeing some kind of difficult times ahead where we have, at least at some point before we get to, you know, I would love to see more car sharing services in the city of Hudson. I would like to see a grocery store right in Hudson, even a small one, so that we can say, oh, look, we have a walkable city where I can go, and I don't have to go out to the shop right on Fairview Avenue.
Well, all of us who are alive now, except people who are 18 and under, were born in the 20th century, the age of the automobile. I mean, we're all like addicted to cars, even those of us who are committed to bicycling and walking and walkability and using public transportation, we still have to rely on cars because that's the infrastructure we have. And so I think, yes, the parking issue, if there's a public conversation about adopting smart code, I think the parking issue is going to be one of the big sticking points. And because it's very hard for people to realize that we're kind of addicted to this system of using individual cars. And even if everybody would say, it would be great if we had a decent bus system so that you could hop on a bus and it would take you out to the supermarket on Fairview Avenue and bring you back, and there would be frequent services, frequent runs of the bus. But it doesn't exist. How do we get there? You know, this is a problem. The parking thing will be a challenge, but it's not an insurmountable challenge. people get kind of panicky and hysterical about thinking there's not going to be enough places to park. And actually, you know, during Flag Day weekend, parking is a problem here. Maybe during Pride weekend, sometimes summer weekends where there are a lot of day trippers in town, it's hard to find a place within a block or two of Warren Street.
Right. But having lived on Warren Street, I can attest to the fact that, you know, it is extremely difficult sometimes and very expensive. This is an addition to your rent.
Yeah.
You have to plan for the parking tickets.
This needs a solution, but it's not that there are no solutions.
Right. And I think it points out that there is certainly we have two issues going on here. We also have to address our transportation issues and our walkability issues.
All these things
issues
are connected, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you want to have if you want to have some kind of public transportation system that would allow people to get to the community college and to the shopping centers and to get from Front Street up to the hospital and back, nobody is going to be able to create a decent transportation system if there aren't enough riders to make it viable.
Right.
And if, as long as people, as long as we feed our addiction to cars, we're not going to have enough riders because everybody's going to just go to the default, which is well, I'm just going to have a car, which, by the way, also costs a lot of people a lot of money, including like people who don't have the
and
money.
And you don't use it very much. I would much rather
it sits there.
I would much rather be able to just call Uber for the tiny little things that I have to do around town.
Yeah, or like maybe we need Zipcars up here or whatever.
Zipcars are a great alternative. I mean, certainly those are things that those are certainly things that we need to plan for as we look at doing smart grids and as our city looks to move forward.
Yeah.
Like it is a rich tapestry of problems, and if we don't address them correctly, we're just kind of kicking the can down the road.
But the solution to everything, the key to all these solutions is density, more density. More density means more a larger supply of apartments and houses to live in, which means it helps control the cost of housing. More density means the better likelihood that we will have transportation systems that make more sense and don't force everyone to have a car. More density makes a more walkable town. It means there is a bigger customer base if somebody were to open a grocery store. Density really, if you're talking about cities, and we live in a city as rural as our surroundings are, this is really a city in a classic sense and in an architectural sense. Density is the key to the health of an urban place.
Absolutely. Jonathan Lerner, thank you so much for joining us. If you would like to read Jonathan Lerner's editorial that he wrote with Walter Chatham, the head of Hudson's Planning Board, we will link to that article in the Register Star. There's as well some links in that article to some more reading on smart codes. This is At Issue. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And having said that, we are now here with State Senate candidate Pat Strong. Pat, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Wonderful. Pat, you are running for State Senate in New York's 46th.
Very good. Yes, and absolutely.
And that goes from where to where?
You want to hear the geography?
I would love to hear the geography of it. I think that it's amazing to learn a little bit more about our bizarre.
Sure. Well, it starts in Southern Ulster, but it's not all of Southern Ulster. So it starts in Highland, but it does not include, for example, Rosendale or New Paul's. So it goes up kind of the middle of Ulster County, does not extend further than Woodstock. Uh-huh. And then we proceed into all of Greene County, all of Montgomery County, the capital of which is Amsterdam, we were just talking about, or rather, not the capital, the largest municipality is Montgomery. And then I have partial Schenectady County, partial Albany County, but no cities.
My goodness, that sounds like a traditionally very Republican district, probably,
yes,
I imagine.
Indeed.
It's a little bit more conservative.
Yes.
So for those of you who don't know, Pat is a businesswoman located out of Kingston, and you work in alternative energy, just solar or
That's
alternative?
Right. No, I promote anything that helps us reduce our carbon footprint. So I started out as a journalist writing about business interface with environmental regulation. That, mm-hmm. that was a big story back in the day. And then I was introduced to the U.S. Department of Energy. I worked there for a while as a contractor, consultant, helping deploy the first solar, the first wind, the first geothermal projects in schools and hospitals. And then I was introduced to our own state energy authority, NYSERDA. So I respond to competitive bids that they put out for help explaining their technologies and getting them deployed in the field. And so I help homeowners and businesses and local governments.
I mean, it's certainly an industry where we've seen a lot of change over, you know, 20 years ago, solar was still kind of fringe. And now it seems like it's very mainstream. You know, Tesla came out with home batteries to make it a lot more accessible for people. We can feed things through smart meters back into the grid.
Right.
You know, is solar fringe anymore? It's pretty mainstream now.
I hear widespread support for it as I go around, and the price coming down has helped enormously.
Is the technology now better suited to a temperate area than it used to be? I mean, we don't have, for months out of the year, we don't have that much sunlight.
Right.
So
right.
Certainly there's
the technology. They're always experimenting with new you know, types of solar, but the basic, you know, silicon panels have been with us for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And they do, as long as the snow melts off them, which it does because the panel melts the snow, you can produce in the winter. It's just not like August.
Year round. Yeah, no, it's not quite as fruitful.
Yeah.
There are some solar energy projects that are going up in the area that that you're running for election. Notably, there is, it's over 100 acres worth of solar farm in Coxsackie. This has been met with a lot of resistance from local community members. I'm not sure if they're being more vocal or if they're really representative of people in Coxsackie, but they do oppose the project. They're saying, hey, this is viable farmland. You know, we don't really want this big, ugly solar farm in our area. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think that a solar panel looks like clean energy, but I also understand that 10 years from now, when solar panels become more ubiquitous, mm-hmm. it's probably going to look like an ugly utility. I mean,
we got here, which is that the initial push in solar was largely for residential or for rooftop solar in businesses and on institutional roofs. And, you know, we, for various reasons, not every roof is suitable for that. So the state has changed some of its regulations to make large-scale solar more attractive. And the reason they're doing that is because we really must reduce our carbon footprint, right? Mm-hmm. Just another study came out last week that the temperature is rising faster than we understood.
Drastic.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of a, hey, this is do or die at this point. Yeah.
Right. So that has brought, and financial incentives have brought players into the marketplace now, making all these proposals around upstate New York. And, you know, I'm not a complete expert on what's going on in Coxsackie, but I've talked to people who are very involved with it. And what I see going on there is kind of exactly what should go on. In other words, there is a project that involves a lot of greenfield, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of residential space mm-hmm. where it's very visible. And the community is justifiably wanting to have lots of say in this. The question I always ask is, can't we plant a lot of trees around this project? But the point that they're making about it being viable land for something else is not mistaken.
Right.
There's another project in Coxsackie. I understand there's a half dozen of them on the boards coming through the system. There's another one where a farmer has made a deal to take farmland that's not that viable and use that. Now, that's a wonderful use of solar, and it's not visible from the road, as I understand it. So, you know, I definitely make a distinction between what kind of land are we using, what are the other uses that it was put to, and can we help a farmer mm-hmm. by helping them monetize the land that was they were only paying taxes on. But there's some interesting strategies, too, that a lot of people are looking at now for what they call dual use. If you do use a green field, can you in fact farm on it? And our friends over at the University of Massachusetts are doing some interesting work about how that lays out, how you structure that, where you put the panels and where you put the farmland.
How you do, really? So would it be interspersed between, or is there like an alternating use?
Sure, yeah. You know, you can do some grazing, certainly, of livestock. around panels. They're very safe. So there's a lot of things that we can yet learn about. But the general principle is, yes, there should be local control. These are big decisions that people are going to have to live with. But we can plant trees. We can certainly look to relocate projects before they get out of the planning board into areas that are more suitable. And Lord knows it'll save an awful lot of energy.
Now, a lot of that energy is not going to people in Coxsackie right now. That energy is being sold back into the grid, and you know, we don't really know where it's going. But for a lot of communities, I mean, you know, obviously you have the benefit of scale when you introduce some of these large solar farm projects. Mm-hmm. You know, is it easier now, because costs of solar panels have gone down, to just focus on individuals in the community, you know, who might want solar for smaller projects right on top of a building?
Well, it's certainly a pretty standardized process now, but not everybody has a viable roof, and not everybody wants to clear cut their land.
Right.
I'm very fortunate in that I live on Broadway in Kingston, where I get tremendous sun, and we put those panels up there with no problem. But, you know, my rooftop solar doesn't go into my house necessarily. It gets fed back into the grid too.
Right, but so it does lower your bill.
It does lower my bill.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so there is a clear benefit there for you as a property owner.
Yeah.
And, you know, people can't get the return on their investment. Are there more grants available to put these large projects in?
You know, for the time being, there are incentives there in place. The chairman of the board of NYSERDA has always said that solar has to stand on its own 2 feet like other industries. I think that's very important to do as soon as fossil fuels are standing on their own 2 feet.
That's a very fair. And, you know, there is a question about when they're standing on their own 2 feet. Are we accommodating for the cost down the line in terms of carbon?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And until we're starting to really apply that across all fuels.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Definitely. So, you know, you're running in the 46th, just to change the topic a little bit. That's a very varied, I mean, Kingston to me is very different than I think Montgomery County probably is, or than a lot of Greene County probably is. What is the defining characteristic of these upstate counties? What are the needs that, it doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum, you know, your need is not being met by your opponent?
Well, there certainly are all kinds of people in the 46, but I'm not sure I would totally agree that we're all so very different. I meet people struggling to pay their taxes, to meet their health care premiums everywhere. You know, everybody understands that their children have to be well educated to have a fighting chance in this economy. There's more things that unite us than divide us. It sounds a little hokey, but it is absolutely true.
Right.
The thing about my opponent, though, is that for those of us, it is a sprawling area. So in my part of the district, we don't see him very often. And I hear the same in the Montgomery County area as well. You know, we don't see him that often. He is a home builder, a non-union home builder in the Capital District. People there tend to be pretty familiar with him. But basically, the larger question about this New York State Senate is, we haven't seen a lot of action out of them. You know, people are worried about what will happen with the elections. Well, how about all the years that have gone by that my opponent has been in there, that we've stalled on so many important initiatives, everything from a woman's right to choose? Lord knows we have to confront that issue now, because what happened in Washington with the appointment of Justice Kavanaugh, we now have to codify Roe versus Wade at the state. And we have prepared for this day. It has passed the New York State Assembly many times, but we couldn't get it through the New York State Senate. It's the same with health care reform. It's the same with criminal justice reform. It's a very long list.
Right, right. Because the New York State Senate is a little bit, it's not quite as cut and dry as Democrat or Republican, is it? We have some Democrats who are caucusing with Republicans.
Well, they've moved along, most of them. They've been handed their hats in the primary defeats that most of them suffered. So I'm, you know, very optimistic that we'll have a true blue Democratic majority.
So that is certainly something to look forward to for a lot of Democrats. Do you feel like the Democrats have left some people out? I was listening to certainly something in a great part of the country. You know, a lot of people who previously identified as Democrats. This was in the New York Times talking about Missouri. You know, there are a lot of pro-life there are a lot of people who were pro-life Democrats in the 90s, mm-hmm. And they just didn't feel comfortable in the party anymore, and so they switched their party affiliation. Mm-hmm. Do we not have a big enough tent, or is the problem that the Democrats aren't selling their positions?
Well, you know, I think these things are entirely cyclical.
Right.
Enrollments for Democrats are up in Greene County, up in Albany County.
They're, I believe that they're neck and neck in Greene County now, aren't they?
Yeah.
Very.
Well, I saw an actual fresh off the printer sheet that showed Democrats were the ones who most recently registered.
Right.
So based on that, yes, they're approaching parity.
And is that people switching parties back, or is that just a demographic change because people are moving to the area?
Unclear.
Unclear.
You know, the collective view is that we're gaining more Democrats. With regard to the rest of the country, you know, I think it really, the pendulum swings. I read a fascinating article about how pro-life women in Texas are gravitating toward Beto O'Rourke. And you know what the galvanizing thing was for them? They said, we want to protect babies at the border as much as babies in utero.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That should be something that they consider. I'm from Texas myself, and I remember growing up, it was a very purple state. It was not the way that it is now.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me to see some of it coming back. In 2008, I think Obama carried 45% of Texas.
Yes.
So there's certainly that will there as mm-hmm. cities are getting bigger in Texas and more vocal and more varied in their
and
populations.
Diverse.
Yes,
yeah.
And more diverse. Yeah. Houston is the most diverse city in the country.
Yeah.
I don't.
No doubt.
Yeah. The
no
first
doubt.
Openly lesbian mayor of any major
That's
city
right.
in the country. And then people just don't understand that with Texas.
Right.
Upstate New York reminds me a lot of that, too. Mm-hmm. We have these kind of little blue dots that are, you know, mm-hmm. we have large red swaths, and in there we have to learn how to interact in a meaningful way to get something done.
Yeah.
Makes local politics so much more interesting.
Absolutely. Well, I was just going to add to that, though. You know, there are the usual stereotypes about which party is going to behave which way. But we've seen some wonderful examples now. Ulster County used to be a Republican-dominated district, but it flipped some years ago. And
Must
so
have
now,
been very frustrating for Woodstockers until that happened.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, we do now have a Democratic county executive. We have a Democratic mayor of Kingston. Both of them have held the line on taxes in a very strict way.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, they've reduced by attrition. They've shrunk programs that, you know, had overgrown. And there's growth happening in the county and in the city of Kingston because of that, because people are experiencing, you know, pretty good economic times.
And a lot of people, you know, upstate, there's a constant complaint about taxes being too high, especially for income. As a business owner yourself, you know, how do you apply mm-hmm. that business sense towards making sure that there's economic opportunity for people upstate?
Right. Yeah, I just walked my tax bill and check into City Hall. I was not happy about writing that check. Not at all. I'm not happy about writing my health premium checks every month either. But, you know, there is a reason we're here. And so the access to the New York City market is at least a contributing factor to why we, frankly, put up with it, right? Why we have the trade-offs that we do between, you know, we could be, you know, trying to locate somewhere else, but we hang in here because, of course, our families are here, our children are here, and the business opportunities are here to reach the New York City market. So, but I do believe that we need to shift the burden of the property tax.
So right before we're at the top of the hour, we may get cut off just for a second
yep.
while we reset that. You are a woman running upstate, and this is a big year for women. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot going on a national and on a local level.
Yep.
I know that your opponent, George Amador, was running a fundraiser very recently, and someone's chief of staff was accused of some improper behavior there. Yep. Was his response correct in that situation?
Yeah.
Initially, he had kind of said, hey, I don't really know what's going on. And then he called back and said, oh, hey, this is not okay.
Yeah.
You know,
well, let me just put that in context for mm-hmm. you. So apparently that was Thursday night. On Sunday, I attended a candidate forum in Sleepy Hollow, which is a tiny community within Coxsackie.
Mm-hmm.
And there were 19 candidates there. One of us was a woman. Mm-hmm. That would be me. So it is a big year for women, but in our neck of the woods, there's plenty of room for more women to enter. And why don't they enter? Well, of course, women have a disproportionate share of the child-rearing duties still to this day. Women have, you know, they earn less on the dollar. But that is the backdrop for this crazy story we heard coming out of Albany about how Thursday night, Senator Simca Felder's chief of staff acted very inappropriately. And what was so striking about it was they're really